Well, good evening, everybody. It's, I think, 1 minute to go, but I suspect that on such an unpleasant night, there won't be that many more attending. So I think we should start. First of all, I'd like to welcome Professor Dippel, who's come from Germany today, to give this lecture. It was a bit of bravado on my part, really, to about 2 weeks ago to suggest to him that he might come, and I'm deeply grateful that in such a short time he was able to come and so graciously accepted our invitation to give a lecture. The reason I invited Professor Dippel is I recently came across an article he had written a few years ago, which was enormously interesting to my mind on the nature of modern constitutions, and in particular how there'd been a really significant change from the old, particularly English, approach to the constitution as, in a sense, backward-looking, restoring something that had got out of kilter. The image of the health of the body politic is very prevalent in 17th century constitutional writings. And so constitutions were very much restoring something that was there but had been lost or distorted. Professor Dippel then looked very closely in this article at some of the early constitutions in the American colonies and states, and I think came up with some really quite interesting and important discoveries about the nature of constitutions and how a really quite important change took place. And so that stimulated me into finding out more about our guest speaker and issuing an invitation, which tonight is the result of all of that. So thank you very much, Professor Dippel, for coming at such short notice. Well, our guest speaker is a distinguished historian of distinguished scholar of constitutional history. He has worked for many years as professor of British and American studies at the University in Kassel. He's been a visiting professor at various places, including the University of Adelaide in Australia, I notice. His writings are enormously extensive on issues of constitutional history, not just in the United States and England, but also in many other parts of Europe and beyond. His present major project is on the public, or concerns the publication of all constitutions since the late 18th century, and that's quite a lot, in a collected set of volumes which will run at completion to about 40. And you can imagine that that is a major undertaking. And perhaps Professor Dippel might just tell us a little bit more about that in his talk. But essentially we are here to hear his views on some of those constitutional historical issues on which he is a leading expert, and which I think have much to say for those of us. This program, this lecture, is part of a wider program of workshops and research, which we call the Social and Political Foundations of Constitutions. And it is a study of the social and political foundations of constitutions. So we're trying to look at not the doctrines of constitutions nor the philosophy of constitutions, but we're trying to understand more the social function, the social role of constitutions, where they come from, what they're trying to do, how they succeed or not, and so generally apply that sort of socio-legal approach to constitutions. And I see this lecture as a very important element in that project. So, Professor Dippel, I welcome you, and we look forward to your talk.
Well, thank you very much for this kind introduction. Thank you very much for the invitation to have the honor to speak to you. It is rare these days, I have to admit, to find a constitutional lawyer who has the idea that a constitutional historian might have something to tell. If you look at least at the curricula of German law schools, I mean, you see that constitutional history, the history of law, is so marginalized that you can become a quite accomplished lawyer without ever having heard anything about it. If that is a good thing for the law and for the constitution, is another thing. So I try to at least to give you my ideas about what I think modern constitutions are all about. And this definitely is different from what you read or have read in the past about comparative constitutional history, or however that might be called. The other day I came across, while doing something quite differently, a sentence which struck my mind and which I should like to quote to you, because I think it really nicely fits into our topic of tonight. The quote is, "But the dogma of the sovereignty of the people, on which all our constitutional theories are grounded, is fraught with revolutions and irreconcilable with order and peace and all regular government." The quote is from 1852. And the title of this book, a very curious book, so curious that it is not even digitized by Google or Microsoft, so it's really very rare today, is "England's Foreign Policy," and then comes the interesting subtitle, "or Grey Wigs and Cotton Wigs, with Lord Palmerston's Pet Belgian Constitution of Catholics and Liberals." The book is so rare that I failed to find much about the author. The author is Thomas Wilson. And perhaps anyone of you knew who that Thomas Wilson was. I have no idea. He might have been, but this is only my personal guess, not founded on any evidence. He might have been the Tory Member of Parliament from London from 1818 to 1826. He died actually in 1852. So he might have, I mean, obviously it was a Tory, I mean, that's for sure, already from the title, but at least also from the contents of the book. But if he's really this Thomas Wilson, this MP from London of the 1820s, I do not know. But I shall appreciate any better information about that. Okay, so what is so fascinating about this quote? It's not, of course, his political philosophy about that. There's this irreconcilable with all government and so on. But it is the idea that he says constitutions, and obviously he's not speaking about the British constitution, constitutions are founded on a constitutional theory. And he obviously has in mind these constitutions he has seen all the way around, that is in Europe in the revolution of 1848. And one of basic element, basic criteria, or as he called it, dogma, of this theory is popular sovereignty. So this brings me to my basic assumption to say, well, what are these constitutions, these modern constitutions, these written documents, which we have since 1776, what are they all about? Is there something with which we can compare them, which is common to them? Or is that just as we defined constitution before the American and French Revolution, as in Britain continues to be the case, just an assemblage of some laws which are basic to the governing the country? You remember the definition of Bolingbroke of 1735, this assemblage of principles along which we consented to govern the country. Is that what is certainly not? Because it is not an assemblage law. It is a written document. But is the idea that it is written, is that the fundamental difference, or is there more behind it? What makes them different from unwritten constitutions? I mean, to my reading also, modern constitutions have a growing amount of being of unwritten parts. The German constitution is a small document, but we can say the unwritten part of it, and now I don't know what is the exact number, 120, something like volumes, of decisions of the federal constitutional court, interpreting the constitution and what it means. Strictly speaking, that is written too, but that is how we now divide, I mean, any more common sense. I mean, even parts of the British Constitution are written. Not everything, but many parts are written because they are statutes. So we come back to the situation of 1775. Why did Americans in 1776 decide that they have to write constitutions? For doing that, we have to look at what happened in these still American colonies, not only in this year, but also in the preceding decades, so back to 1763. The basic element for our topic, it's not all to be reduced to that, but what is really important for us is that there is a continuing lively debate about the British Constitution and its meaning. And this goes on and on and on. And it does not end up what you can read quite often, but whether it's wrong. It's not ending up in rejecting the British Constitution. Still in 1776, you find numerous statements by Americans writing in newspapers and in pamphlets about the excellence of the British Constitution. But what was the problem? What did they do, really? They interpreted the British Constitution. They said the British Constitution is based on principles. The British Constitution is about rights. These are basic elements, and these are tremendously important to them. And the way they interpret this, and they even do not hesitate to send their interpretation to the Lord Chancellor in London, he must have been shocked by what he had to read there, is an interpretation which more and more departs from the received or accepted British interpretation of the British Constitution. And they do that in a situation where the political situation is completely different. And that is their problem. They say, that is what really the British Constitution is about. It is about these principles. It is about rights. But the British politics are just the opposite. It's a tyrannical government, which tries to enslave us. I mean, they were a bit paranoid about it. But the British Constitution did not live up to what it really intends to do. So something went wrong. This curing of rights, which is a principle of the British, did not function anymore. So we have not to say the British Constitution is to be rejected, but what we have to do, especially then in a situation when, as you remember, in April 1775, the war broke out. So the British would say the American mob was rampant in the streets, and which led to the situation that the British governors were threatened that they fled the country to the closest British warship. So for the Americans, the civil government was broken down, and they had to constitute a new government. Of course, on the basis of a constitution, which should take the major elements of the British Constitution, but better than the British had done, in order to prevent that it could go wrong again, that the government could become tyrannical again. They had to write a constitution which really secured rights. And that is the basic element which we have when you look at what Americans said. And interestingly enough, people fight the same arguments in 1789 in France. The constitution is about securing rights. And you have to write a constitution on these principles that it will assure that it can secure rights. therefore you need a declaration of rights. And this kind of declaration is not what we assume them to be, a list listing up the rights you have. Now, it's a document which contains the principles on which the Constitution is based, in order that it may really secure these rights humans have. And here, in this point, is a major difference to, which is not that much vocalized in this time, but which we would say from today, between the British and the modern constitutions. See, the problem between what, how do we have these rights assured? Granting or guaranteeing? Are these rights which are granted to us? Then there's a question, who grants? Of course, that the government grants. And the government that grants can take it away. So that is not the idea of rights. We do not have these rights because there is a generous government which grants these rights to us. We have our rights because they are natural human rights. And they are not granted to us by government. We have them quite independent of any government. We have them due to our nature. And all the Constitution has to do, and then the government, of course, is to guarantee the rights. Because they belong to us independently of this government. But they have to be guaranteed, not granted. In Germany, in the 19th century, especially in the second half of the 19th century, there will be a long discussion whether the rights are granted or guaranteed. And of course, the autocratic German government, etc. Granted at best, not guaranteed. And this is only one example. I mean, you can take any other example. You'll find many of them, I guess, still today. So, rights are something which belong to human nature. There comes a new element in it, which is, of course, natural right, or however you may call that. And the Constitution has to guarantee these rights. And they have to guarantee this in a declaration of rights preceding a constitution. The wonderful statement from Rousseau in 1789 said quite the same thing. That we have to have these guaranteed in a declaration of rights, and these are the principles on which a constitution is based. And never mix these two things. A constitution might change. Rights, never. And if you look at them in America, we have, quite as in France, and in, we have in 1789 the Declaration of Rights, and the Constitution follows up in 1791. Well, this was a political process. You could say, well, there may be other factors who caused this delay. But if you look at the first American constitutions from the year 1776, which have a Declaration of Rights, these are two documents which were adopted on different days, and they were two parts of one common document which we may then call Constitution. The first part is the Declaration of Rights, the second part is a form of government. But all they call that Constitution. But there is a feeling about this, that these are different things, and that the one has to precede. This was a notion which got lost, even in America, quite rapidly, due to the American Constitution, the Federal Constitution. We have the first state constitution in 1790, which puts the Declaration of Rights at the end of the document. So that is a complete turning upside down the original idea of what a constitution is about. So much as short as possible about the origins. So what are the consequences of this? In the late 18th century, starting from 1776 in America, 1789 in France, and there are even a few documents in between, the Constitution Project in Tuscany from the 1780s. We have a constitution in Galicia in 1790, that is also before the French, the Polish constitution, which is before the French constitution. And then it goes on, and every county up to today has a constitution, a written constitution, in a single document, with the exception of Great Britain, Israel, and New Zealand, for different reasons. Is there any other political idea which spread universally in a so short a time, in a number of decades, not even two centuries? It's amazing. How did that come about? Why, all over the world, from one end to the other, set people down writing constitutions. And not only constitutions, but constitutions in the sense of modern constitutionalism. With this, I should give you that. These principles which I mentioned, I figured out that there were 10 principles which are the core element of modern constitutionalism. I understand them, and I always have to look for these 10 elements in order not to forget them. Sovereignty of the people, you heard about that. Universal principles. We base our constitution not on some localism, which is only true here in this situation, because it is true everywhere. You have these rights everywhere, wherever you are. It's not based to the place here. Human rights, representative government, constitution as paramount law, separation of powers, limited government, responsibility and accountability of government, judicial independence, and the right of the people to reform their own government, or what the Americans call the amending power. The people. And before I move on with this idea about how the spread over the world, one sentence more to the British, to the French Declaration of Rights. It is not only important that it reflects the same ideas, and you will find many of these principle of modern constitutionalism in the French Declaration of Rights. The first time we have these 10 elements is in the Virginia Declaration of Rights of the 12th of June, 1776. But what we have, and we do not find this in America at this time, and not even later, what we do have in the French Declaration of Rights of 1789 is this famous Article 16, which says, any society in which the guarantee of rights is not assured, nor the separation of powers determined, has no form of constitution. So you have here, in other words, than Thomas Wilson in 1852, the constitutional theory. A constitution, in the understanding of modern constitutionalism, is based on principles. And the French Declaration in Article 16 mentions two, human rights and the separation of powers. As we know, this is not all. There are more to that. But if you do not have these principles, or at least a reasonable number of them, included in your constitution, You cannot call this a constitution of modern constitutionalism. You may, for convenience, call it a constitution, but it has nothing to do with modern constitutionalism. So back to the idea, why did this spread so rapidly over the world? And this is a story really we do not know. Nobody ever investigated that. That is what modern constitution is about. This spreading up the ideas of modern constitution, how do we come to these constitutions with these ideas, with these core principles, more or less in it, spreading over the world. You can go wherever you want. Just for amusing myself, I read the Constitution of the People's Republic of China 2 days ago. You find all these 10 elements in the Constitution of China. Why? We know that the Chinese situation of today differs quite a lot from that. But why did they find it necessary, at least in a formal sense, to include these principles, judicial independence, human rights, universal principles, to include this in their constitution? And so you can look to, I'm sure it will be in the constitution of Iran or North Korea or wherever. I mean, can you give a few examples just to show you, what is, the idea or the working behind. Of course, in the 19th century, there were numerous people who were fascinated by these principles. You may call them Democrats, liberals, radicals, whatever you want, or revolutionists, whatever you want, Jacobins. Many people would like to call them Jacobins. And of course, they would like to bring these principles into their constitution. And of course, there were the opposing forces of traditionalists or whatever you may call them, who are opposed to that. So the constitutions of the 19th century, if you look at Europe, wherever you want, if you look at Latin America, and then spreading to the rest of the world, they were compromises between these forces, fighting for these elements or opposing them. We have in all the French revolutionary constitutions of the 1790s, we have these elements, more or less all of them. There are a few exceptions to which I may come later. And then we have the 18th Brumaire, with Napoleon coming to power and making the constitution of the year 8. None of these elements are in its constitution. As in the rest of the Napoleonic constitutions in France, at least up to 1814, the Acte Additionnel is a bit different. And then there is the fall of Napoleon. And we have in 1814, 1815, three drafts, let's say, for a new constitution. The project of the Senate, a declaration of the rights of Frenchmen, and a project from the House of Representatives. And all these elements come in again, or at least quite a lot of them, 6, 7. But the day was ruled by, of course, as we know, the Charte of 1814. And here again, you find, at the most one or two, but none of the rest. Even conservative opponents to these modern constitutions had at least at that time to accept that they needed a constitution. The Bourbons being restored to the throne of France, of course, they would have loved to go completely back to the old happy days before 1789. But they had to learn that they need to have a constitution. They could not give any legitimation to their rule in France without a constitution. At least they would not like to call it a constitution. So they called it the Charte Constitutionnelle. But that dictum from Thomas Paine, I mean, that really sticks to the mind. Where is it? Government without a constitution is power without a right. The Eastern European autocratic powers resisted a bit longer. But in the end, that is, after the revolution of 1848, Russia still a bit later, they also had to accept that they had to have a constitution. But of course, they did not want to write all these elements, these principles of modern constitutionalism in it. Hardly anyone did. The whole German history, again, coming back to Germany, of the 19th century is a history of resistance against separation of powers. Nonsense. All the power is in the monarch. Emanates from the monarch. This was a monarchical principle which had to be accepted by everyone. Every idea about separation of powers was nonsense. So we had to wait in Germany until 1919 to have the first constitution, in fact, which accepted the idea of the separation of powers. So the history of modern constitution is a history of the struggle of these principles, of those who wanted to have these ideas, or at least as many as possible, in the constitutions, and the opponents who wanted to have, if possible, none of them in their constitutions. And in between, you have these modifications, diversions, perhaps a bit of it, perhaps a bit of human rights, perhaps a representative government, yes, but with a high census. So that the right people are represented. That is what we see, and we can even go to America. I mean, if you go to look at the state constitutions, the constitution of Louisiana of 1812, the first constitution was under which the state was Louisiana was admitted as state into the Union. No declaration of the sovereignty of the people, not even in the very vague form the U.S. Constitution has. We, the people, do ordain and establish this constitution. You can say is at least in some way the adoption of the principle of the sovereign people. Not even that. No human rights and a number of others not included. And this goes on. I mean, we are not speaking about history. You may look at the election in the U.S. last week. In Iowa, the three judges of the Supreme Court of Iowa were ousted. They were ousted because the Supreme Court of Iowa, a few years ago, had accepted gay marriages. These three judges, according to the Iowa Constitution, stood up for retention in office this year. So they had to be confirmed. So 50% of the Iowans had to say, yes, go on. In order to prevent that from happening, huge sums of money from outside, from conservative groups in the United States, poured money into Iowa and made a campaign to oust these judges. So they were not confirmed. Well, you may say, well, what a wonderful victory for the sovereign people. But you may say, what a horrible attack on an independent judiciary. What American judge who is elected by the people, as in most of the American states is the case, will freely rule in the future for minority rights when he knows that there may be a majority in the state, or even beyond, not even in, I mean, the Iowans, without this money coming from unknown sources from outside of Iowa, they may have, presumably because there's no campaign for these judges to be confirmed, no political campaign really, may really dare to stand up for minority rights. So the independent judiciary is a problem. And this brings me to my last remark, and I said I would speak for 30 minutes. I already passed 30 minutes. I'm sorry for that, but I close very shortly. I mentioned the Constitution of China. I could mention any other constitution. You need not to just write this down in the Constitution. You may give life and vigor to these principles. And here the problem comes in. There should not be no excuse for China. Here the problem comes in. If you look closely at these principles, these 10 principles, which I mentioned to you, to some extent they are self-contradictory. There is a contradiction in a strict logical sense between the sovereignty of the people and the Constitution as a paramount law. The French history from 1789 up to the middle of the 20th century, so for more than 1.5 century, is the history of the conflict between these two principles. If there is a conflict between the Constitution and the sovereign people, who or what survives? French rule for more than 1.5 century was the people. That is why they changed the constitution every 15 years or so. The American answer is quite the opposite. If there is a conflict between the people and the constitution will prevail. There is a conflict, a logical conflict, between, I just mentioned that, between popular sovereignty and an independent judiciary. So what modern constitutionalism is about, and what you need to do, and of course here again the answers will be different from country to country, is how to bring these principles, which to some extent are contradictory to each other, into a balance and make them work. The French people giving superiority to the people over the Constitution had this problem quite vividly before them. In 1848, they introduced rigidly the separation of powers. They set up a president for the first time. Again, an adoption from America, president of the republic, and they set up the legislature, both elected directly by the people. So what is, and these two branches are in conflict with each other. How do you solve this conflict? In the situation of the French general philosophy that the people are supreme, you cannot solve this within the Constitution. And they did not do that. The result is we know. 3 years later, Louis Napoleon decided that he would be the successor of his uncle and would be emperor. And that was the end of the Constitution. So modern constitution is not only about these principles, certainly it is about these principles, and how they are incorporated in a constitution, and how to give vigor and life to these principles. But it is also about how to balance these contradicting principles in order to make the constitution really work. And I guess that is what we have seen over the last 200 years. But it is a story which has still to be written.